Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show and Podcast. This is number 823, and you'll want to put this number down on your piece of paper or in your iPhone or Android and to bring it up again and again, because we have a special guest for you, the Dr. James Hamlin. He's not only a senior editor at The Atlantic, but he's a physician who's really made a career of making things understandable for all of us. That's exactly the goal of You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, taking the latest in scientific knowledge and making it so that you can take control of your genes and live at the top of your curve for as long as you want, and that's what he does so well. So, Jim, can I call you Jim, or do you want me to call you Dr.
Yeah,
Hamlin?
Please.
What would you like to be called?
No need for formality.
Okay, so I do want to, and I will remind people, the book that he wrote, If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining the Human Body. It's out by Doubleday and available now on Amazon. I might as well call you Dr. Hamlin so people know that they can Google H-A-M-B-L-I-N and find, or go to Amazon and put that name in and find this book. Dr. Hamlin, first of all, how did you got out of medical school, and instead of going into practice immediately or totally, you became a senior editor at The Atlantic. You became a journalist. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's an atypical path for sure. I started doing a radiology residency. So I did my general medicine internship and then 2 years of diagnostic radiology, you know, reading CTs and MRIs and X-rays. And I just wasn't passionate about it. I wasn't sure that that's what I wanted to do for the next 50 years of my life. And I took a little hiatus from residency. And during that time, The Atlantic was looking for someone to come on at a low level and edit health stories. And they gave me a shot at it since I had a relatively good background in terms of my body of knowledge on the subject. And then I got some opportunities to write while I was there, and it's been reasonably well received, and I really enjoyed it. So now it's been 5 years, and now I got the opportunity to write a book as well. So here I am. Well,
and the book is is basically questions and answers, recurrent questions. So let's go to a couple of them. One of which people always ask me, and because I talk about the health benefits of caffeine. For those who are fast metabolizers, talk to us. One of the questions you have, does caffeine, and this is typical, so I would say, why isn't there a female Viagra, and why do heartbeats mess up, and penicillin is made of mold? So there are a lot of questions. Is there anything I can do productively with my dead body? And you talk about contacts going into the brain. But how do vaccines work? And does caffeine make me live longer? Two questions I want to cover, but let's talk about caffeine. Does caffeine make me live longer?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you're getting a sense for the expansiveness of the book here, which is based on real questions that people came to me with. So, caffeine seems to have, if you look at the longest live populations in the largest studies, life often involves a moderate amount of caffeine. So that tends to be the best evidence that we have. There are proposed mechanisms for how that would work. But the experts that I've spoken to have said that similar to red wine, there are also correlations with longer life and good health among people who have 1 to 2 glasses a day. But that it's not so compelling that if you don't enjoy it, or you know, don't do it, that you should go out of your way to start doing it. So that's where I come down on both caffeine and the alcohol question.
Now, in your in your answer in the book, you also teach us and teach the reader about Duchenne or how the FDA approves health claims and why there's no claim for coffee or some other things that may be beneficial to the majority of people. Tell us a little bit about what Duchenne is and how this process works.
Yeah, so that's a law that was passed in the 90s, which set up a standard for how supplements, chemicals that we would be regulated as supplements in this country, would be taken to market. And it essentially established two different industries. You have the pharmaceutical industry, which we, when we classify something as a pharmaceutical, it needs to be proven to be effective, and it has to carry a laundry list of side effects and claims. You know, you've seen the commercials, and they have half of the commercial is just a list of unwanted side effects. And it takes a lot of money and many years to bring a pharmaceutical to market. On the other side, you have, because of this Duchenne law, supplements can be taken to market immediately, and they're more retroactively regulated. So if people, if it proves that people are being hurt by a product, the FDA will attempt to remove it from the market. But and there's also a lot more leniency in terms of what supplements can, the labels on supplements can claim that they do. Like they can't make specific disease claims like cures Alzheimer's disease, but they can say things like boosts brain health, and they don't need to provide studies to back that up before writing it on the label and selling it. So that's a tougher area for a lot of consumers to make sense of, and I see a good amount of profiteering going on in that space and sort of playing off of people's hopes that a lot of these things work, even if the evidence for them is pretty scant.
And but in some of these, in fact, you talk about why, for instance, even though you say that coffee is in fact healthful, why there's no label that coffee is in fact healthy on the package, if you will.
Yeah. So people who are sell, in terms of the way that foods are regulated, I think there are, if it's regulated as a supplement, as I use an example of a caffeine product that's Bulletproof Coffee, which is regulated in that way, not as a pharmaceutical, you can't promise life-enhancing effects. If you were going to promise these sorts of effects on the human body, I believe that would make it a pharmaceutical. So we don't treat our food as in the same way we treat medicines, even though we know that the relationship between dietary choices, and that includes what we drink, is for most of us the single biggest factor in what determines our health and longevity is what we choose, how we choose to fuel our body. So it seems there might be a need for some middle ground where we can allow foods to talk more about their health benefits with some sort of oversight from scientists who can say whether or not these claims are true and justified without having this vast distinction between medicines and all the other chemicals that we put inside of ourselves.
Well, since we are, in fact, I guess in the new era, and I guess you will follow this as the senior editor for health at The Atlantic, has Trump named a new FDA commissioner? Does he get that right? And how long, and if so, has he named someone, and what's their position on that middle ground, do you know?
I am woefully not sure of where this stands right now. I would imagine if it's consistent with anything that he has done so far, there's a move towards, and this tends to be how ideologically people divide along these lines, is hoping that you want less government. So therefore, you'd want the ability for companies to be able to come in and sell whatever they want, brain potion that promises to boost brain power 60%. And you don't want big government getting in the way of that. Just free capitalism. And, of course, no one wants government messing unnecessarily in anyone's business, but if someone is making claims like that, then ideally you have a strong regulatory agency that will be able to step in or prevent them from bringing it to market in the first place.
Yeah, one of the problems, I guess you're saying, with a free market that doesn't have someone making sure they have only reliable claims is that the advertisements can make everything look awful good even when it isn't.
Yeah, and I think health is a unique space there, right? Because if you start selling cars and you say, well, this car is going to be good for 200,000 miles and it can go 200 miles an hour and take 50 miles on a gallon of gas, people can pretty quickly tell that that isn't the case, and they know they're being fooled. But if you're selling a vitamin supplement and it promises that it's going to add, years to your life, it's really hard to disprove that. And it's really tempting for people to say, okay, it's probably false, but I'll go ahead and try it, because even if it only adds a week to my life, it's worth it. But false advertising and messing around with people's hopes for their health and longevity is very serious business. So my hope is that there is an agency in place that can help protect people from predatory practices.
One of the other things that I love the way you covered vaccines in the book. So you say, how do vaccines work? And it's a wonderful synopsis of why they work as well. Do you want to share that with people? You want them to have to go and look it up in the book. The book is called, it's by James Hamlin, and we're talking with James Hamlin, who's a physician and senior editor at The Atlantic. The book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. It's a wonderful book. Go ahead. Do you want to tell us how vaccines work, or
thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to. Yeah, and I kept it pretty straightforward in the book, because I figured most of the people who read my writing pretty regularly are not tend to believe in scientific evidence, and even though we hear a lot about people who foster conspiracy theories about, vaccines being harmful, it's a very small number of people. So I just explained the basic mechanism of it, which I think can help people to make sure that they feel comfortable with it, which is to say that vaccines expose a person to a non-harmful part of a bacterium or virus and are able to stimulate an immune response in a way that makes the person able to ward it off should the actual harmful version of that microbe ever decide to infect them. So you're exposed to, say, just one protein from a particular virus, but that stimulates your own immune system to put up these big walls and create a barrier, and that way you're protected when the full actual dangerous virus comes around. So it's a really ingenious invention, and the interesting thing about it, I think, is that it's one of the very few things that the evidence is so clear for. There's so many other parts of medicine when you're talking about certain blood pressure medications or cholesterol lowering medications where you say, it probably is good for some people. We're not certain how big the benefit is. Here's one where we have a very clear-cut case. One of the one of the most clear-cut in the history of science and medicine. And yet it's one where people tend to be the most reluctant to accept it.
Now, let me go and switch gears and just ask, because I didn't see this question, but how long do you think we will? You've written a book on If Our Bodies Could Talk. When we're 100, will our bodies talk to us? Will we start to extend lifespan as we did in the 20th century, in the 21st century? So how long do you expect us to live?
Yeah. You know, what I found in the course of researching this is the interesting point that if you look at our average lifespan, how long people are living, it really has shot up in the last 100 years. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but you're looking at, you know, people in recent centuries who were living half as long as we live now. So a lot of people then think, oh, well, that means we're going to be living to 200 before long. But if you look at the longest-lived people, you know, the oldest people to ever walk the face of the earth, we really haven't increased our maximum potential. Maybe by a few years, but there have been people who live into their hundreds, you know, a much smaller percentage, but there have been people throughout recorded history. So we know we don't reasonably expect that that upper limit is surpassable. I guess to draw an analogy, like a lot of cars are much faster, but we haven't, but just because the fastest possible car, it doesn't necessarily translate to the average. So, yeah, maybe a totally unnecessary and terrible analogy. But the upper limit might slowly continue to increase, and we might each individually expect that the averages will continue to rise. But I wouldn't expect anybody to be living to 150 or 200 anytime soon.
Okay, so we have a bet. I'm going to take you on that because in the aging research community, Dr. Hamlin, the betting is that by 2030, the average lifespan for those born in 2030 will be over 120. And so, assuming I can live till 2030, we have a bet of a dinner. Okay.
That sounds good to me.
You come to Cleveland.
You know what? I'll be happy if...
I come to New York if you win.
I'll be happy if the world is a prosperous place and everyone is so safe and well-fed and well-cared for that we have the opportunity to do that. And I wouldn't write it off on the in terms of possibilities, but I'm more skeptical, I guess.
I hope you were right, that it is prosperous and that we both are living in 2030. And if so, we have a bet. This is a wonderful book. We're going to say thank you to Dr. James Hamlin, H-A-M-B-L-I-N, If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He teaches us that vaccines really start out with a toxoid, that is something that's toxic. Then, and in fact, that's maybe why there are some side effects with vaccines, but comes back to the conclusion, much like we do, that the benefit is more than 40,000 times the risk, and there's a clear benefit to vaccines. So make sure you do get your vaccinations up to date, and do see your physician, as some of the recommendations, such as getting a second Zostavax or shingles vaccine at age 65, of getting the two pneumonia vaccines in addition to what will change with the influenza vaccine, are changing. But this is a marvelous, marvelous book that answers a whole bunch of questions, such as, and I love some of them, can I get rid of my eyelashes? What makes hair grow? So he doesn't do just, in fact, the simple things or talk about hydration and the important things, but he does talk about how to sit and a lot of This is a marvelous book. Thanks, Dr. Hamlin. I will use this and keep reading it and keep learning from it. So I want to thank you a lot for doing that. You're listening to Podcast 823 of You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. Come back. Remember, 824, guest Jean Chatsky, and 825, she's a duver. And remember the great podcast of the recent past. Probably my favorite is Charlie Hennekin's on the toothpaste that decreases inflammation. We'll be right back next week with a new You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show and podcast. Thanks for listening, and thanks, Sonar, for wonderful engineering as usual.